Estás escuchando LP Podcast.
Buenas noches a todos nuestros amigos conectados, a todas y todos bienvenidos. Una nueva sesión del LP, todos los participantes de esta nueva sesión, gracias por acompañarnos. Todos los que nos visitan por primera vez, bienvenidos. Los que nos acompañan cada semana, muchas gracias por compartir en este espacio, a través de esta pandemia de locos. Buenas noches, Mauro. Buenas noches, Alejo. ¿Cómo están?
Hola a todos. ¿Cómo vamos? Bueno, hoy una fecha muy especial para el EP. Tenemos un disco muy, muy clave en los 90s, el Super Unknown de Soundgarden. Fue el cuarto álbum de estudio de Soundgarden, lanzado 8 de marzo de 1994. Es una joya de la música y de mis favoritos personalmente. Entonces hoy tenemos una super sesión porque tenemos un gran invitado.
Hola, buenas noches a todos. Soy Alejandro. Bienvenidos a los nuevos. Como decía Mauro, esto es un invitado y un disco icónicos del rock. Es un disco que debutó en el número uno, el Billboard 200. Vendió 310 mil copias o más en la primera semana que salió. Ganó 2 Grammys. Estuvo nominado como mejor álbum de rock y ha vendido más de 9 millones de copias a nivel mundial. Es el disco de Soundgarden más exitoso hasta el momento. Y bueno, bienvenidos a esta sesión de LP y esperamos que disfruten.
Alejo, Mauro, hoy tenemos como invitado a un productor de rock alternativo por naturaleza. Se trata de Michael Beinhorn. Acerca de Michael les puedo contar que inició su carrera a principios de los años 80 en la agrupación Material, donde interpretaba el teclado. Luego participó en la orquesta de Herbie Hancock como escritor y productor, con quien ganó un Grammy. En los años 90 se convierte en uno de los productores más respetados del círculo del rock alternativo, trabajando junto a bandas como Red Hot Chili Peppers, Hole, Marilyn Manson, Aerosmith, Korn, Soul Asylum, Violent Femmes, Soundgarden, entre otros. En el 98, además de ser nominado por su participación como productor en los álbums Celebrity Skin de Hole y Mechanical Animals de Marilyn Manson, es el primer productor en debutar en la misma semana en el Billboard Top 10 con estos dos discos anteriores. Welcome to LP, Michael. How are you?
I'm great, thanks. How are you?
We're very good, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
So, Michael, so as you already know, Mauricio and Manuel, we three are the moderators of the LP podcast. Mauricio lives in Mexico City, but he's Colombian. He works as a production manager, basically working on tours, shows all around the world. Mauricio is a very talented friend, musician and singer, and I'm a sound engineer, and I mix mainly movies and TV shows. In the group, we have friends who are like chefs, lawyers, doctors, a lot of professions, but what centers us all in the group is like listening to music and loving music and enjoying music, collecting music, and everything that has to, in one way or another, relate to music. So thank you very much for accepting the invitation. It's an honor for us, for you to be here. And we hope to have a great, great and wonderful chat.
The pleasure is mine.
Okay. So Michael, like we were telling you, we're going to do groups of 3 songs of the record, and then we'll go into a little questions, and then everybody's going to be muted except us three. Basically, everybody's just going to have a really good time, and we're just going to be really digging the album, and that's the idea here in El EP. Entonces, todos, muchas gracias por estar acá. Vamos a empezar, vamos a oír por tandas de 3 canciones. Recuerden no hacer preguntas por el chat, los micrófonos, por favor, muteados. Y la entrevista va a ser en inglés para que entonces pues tengamos eso en cuenta, y después vamos a subir todo esto a nuestra página web www.lppodcast.com. Entonces, no siendo más, ya estamos listos para empezar.
So Michael, are you ready?
That seemed a little premature, but yeah, I'm ready.
Yeah. Cool. That's our thing.
Okay, man. Cool. Let fly.
Let it fly, okay. Man.
Okay. So, Michael, first question. You started to mature as a musician and a producer in a very interesting period in the late 70s. How did you use this influence of or taste for this really good music that was done in this period, that post-punk, electronic, prog rock, even some jazz? How did you use this in producing very straightforward, visceral rock albums in the 90s, like Super Unknown and Hole's Celebrity Skin, for example?
Well, I didn't really fancy myself as being much of a rock fan to start with, so I thought that made me an ideal candidate. I didn't really like the way people were producing rock records in that period, and I came from, I guess, more of a funk and R&B background, and having worked on some early hip-hop records, and of course the record that we did with Herbie, you know, I kind of applied that aesthetic to making records like Super Unknown, where there's more emphasis on the rhythm section and there's more emphasis on low end sounds. I was finding that a lot of records that people were making, you know, especially through the 80s and into the 90s, were getting really thin, and there was more focus on like vocals and guitars, and people weren't really thinking about the groove of a song, you know, where that kind of laid. And that's how I applied a lot of what I did. Also, the work I did with electronics was really, it was about getting different textures and stuff like that. On a record like Super Unknown, I didn't really want to get like bog standard rock, you know, guitar sounds that people were getting. I wanted to try and get something that was different, that kind of held its own, and that was sort of, that moved against the overcompressed, heavily saturated guitar sounds that people were getting at that time. So, you know, and also I'd begun listening to a lot of techno music at that point, so that kind of influence came in as well. I'm sure you can hear it all over the record, by the way.
So Michael, Soundgarden was a 4-member band. Each one was key to their sound. How was the process of working with each one of them to create like this collective result?
Honestly, it was a tough record to make, you know, working with each one of them. I mean, they all brought their, you know, unique thing to the table. And I think it was just a matter of creating like a unified sound that was different than their other records. And, you know, that took some doing. I think they wanted to make a different kind of record than the one that we wound up making, I think. I think they wanted to just kind of run into the studio and knock some songs out and then go on tour. And that's definitely not what happened. So working with that was like herding cats, basically. But, you know, I think it worked out okay.
Really? Yeah, yeah.
Well, thank you.
You did good, man.
I tried.
Michael, there's a dark atmosphere in most of the songs of this record, a tension that can be heard very clearly in songs like Fell on Black Days on Black Hole Sun, for example. How was the processing of printing this atmosphere so clearly in the recording?
You know, I think once you have music that kind of reflects that reflects a specific atmosphere, you have to use all the ingredients at your disposal to kind of reflect that atmosphere. And that really comes down to actually working with the individual sounds to kind of hone everything, you know, and to get the kind of tonal qualities and performance qualities. I mean, there's a very deliberate kind of feel to the record, and that's totally there on purpose. You know, I don't know that they were necessarily thinking about it, but it was already there in the music. So it really wasn't hard for me to reflect that, you know. I mean, there's something else too, like there has to be elements of contrast, you know, that work in a record like this to make it, to give it the kind of effect that it needs. It can't all be one way. I find when people make records now, they don't think in those terms. They just think in terms of everything being monochromatic and sort of going in one direction. But really, in order to make the emotional impact of something greater, I feel it's always important to employ elements of contrast. You know, I mean, if you have a song like a Super Unknown, let's say, that has beautiful elements to it, you know, you want to enhance those beautiful elements, but at the same time, you want to create tension with that, create an edge to kind of like, to work with that. I mean, it kind of works against it, but it works with it because it's in the same space. They're kind of forced together. And that's really where the contrast happens, if that makes sense.
Michael, I have another question for you. Like, now that you say that, how much was kind of like, of course, a lot of this tension that we're talking about was done by the band, by the songs, no? But how much of this was kind of like you're doing in that whole production process?
Well, you know, I will state very with great certainty that the record that we started with is not the record that you hear now. I was presented with a cassette tape that had about 11 or 12 songs on it when I got involved in the project. And I think three or four of them wound up on the record and the rest of them were tossed because, excuse me, they didn't really have the record that we needed to make. And my feeling was at that point that they needed to write, you know, that we really needed to work on building a better catalog of songs for this album. And that took about 2 months, which is amazing because I don't know how many bands would actually be able to do that in that kind of, in that amount of time, to go from having just a stuff that might have made a decent record to having a whole bunch of songs where I'd say just about every song on the record has some stands on its own. And, you know, so from that perspective, I did my job. Sonically, that was a whole different thing because, again, the record being done in such a deliberate fashion, it was the sonic elements of it were kind of, that was sort of my domain. That was pretty much my exclusive domain, as a matter of fact, because I know that no one else on the record agreed with me at all. They just kind of fought tooth and nail against everything that I was doing, including the engineer, funnily enough. Like, they didn't want it to be deliberate. They didn't want it to kind of, you know, for it to have the kind of detail that it had, which I felt that was so important, and I was willing to take them all on about it. You know, I mean, at the end, I think that they looked back at it and they were kind of like, okay, this isn't so bad after all. But, you know, I mean, in terms of arrangements and stuff like that, in terms of tweaking the songs, I didn't really have to do much of anything, which is unusual because most of the time I do. But in this case, it, you know, everything came pretty much fully formed. And at that point, all I had to do was apply a very specific sonic signature to everything.
Bueno, recuerden, amigos, por favor, seguirnos, inscribirse en lppodcast.com. Ahí podemos hacer toda la parte de la inscripción de los que no han hecho para que corramos la voz, por favor. Síganos también, por favor, en LP Podcast Facebook y lp.podcast en Instagram. Entonces, vamos con la siguiente pregunta. Michael, are you there?
I am.
Hi, you've said in various interviews that you would never go into the studio without doing pre-production with a band. Why do you think pre-production to make an album is so important?
Well, you're listening to the results. Look, there was a time when I think people were able to make really good music. They just sort of sitting down with a guitar and knocking a couple of chords out, working out a melody, some lyrics. You know, but there ain't no more Muddy Waters or anyone like that. And people can't make records like that anymore. You know, I think the ability to do that is just gone. And more people are relying on being able to multi-track instruments and having a lot of other ideas that augment, instruments that augment their musical ideas. And people simply don't write songs that have that kind of emotional power when you hear them. It takes a lot of time to flesh a piece of music out. Obviously, some of these songs are exceptional in that sense, but it took a long time to actually get some of them to be written. So without that process, again, we wouldn't have had the kind of record that we have. And that's been the case on every record that I've ever worked on. It's imperative to have preparation.
Yeah, but now that you mention it, like, of course, making a good song takes time and effort. But in today's music, with modern technology, everything is done much faster, squared. Everything seems to be like in its place, but it's just based on a formula, soulless in many ways. No, how do we create good, memorable songs in a time where Spotify is forcing us to spit out a product every week in order to survive?
Well, it's not just Spotify. I mean, this is the direction that the music business has been going in for decades. You know, I mean, the end result of this particular cycle, I think, is that people who manufacture music want to be in complete control of it. So I think the direction is to create music via AI, which if you've heard the results of that, I'm sure you know that they're probably a long way off from being able to do anything that you'd ever want to listen to. But the thing is that for a long time now, people haven't been making records where you have that same kind of urgency and that kind of emotional investment. You know, I mean, we're living super unknown right now, obviously. It's a record that was made in 1993. It's almost 30 years old, you know? I mean, it's getting close. It's almost 30 years old. Jesus. And like, but people still listen to this record. People still love this record. That's insane. I mean, I have no problem with it. It makes me very happy because people tell me all the time, oh, it's such a good record. And it is a good record. I know this. But the thing is that by all rights, people shouldn't be listening to this record anymore. Like, you know, I remember when I was growing up in the 1970s and, you know, doo-wop music, which is music that was like 15, 16 years old, that was still getting played at radio, but we would laugh at it because it was preposterous. It sounded so old-fashioned and quaint, and it had no relationship to how we felt as kids. You know, I mean, I love doo-wop music now, but that's beside the point. You know, the main point is that music has always developed. It's always evolved naturally. And we've hit a point right now where it's not evolving at all, where it's just kind of in this stasis right now. It's kind of the brakes have been hit for a while. And the main reason for that from people aren't willing to emotionally invest themselves in the music that they do. Yeah, I mean, rushing plays a great big part in making people's music now because we simply don't have the resources to work. But if you try and allocate your resources and consider, okay, I don't have enough money to do X, Y, and Z, I have to figure out a different way to do this so you can feel the commitment at the back end. I mean, people technically talk about ergonomics and the ease of making a record. I can assure you that no one who listens to a record gives a very shit about your ergonomics or how easy it was for you to make a record or what kind of plugins you used. They just want to hear good music. And if they don't hear anything that inspires them, it's going to be boring to them. You know, pop music has got like a certain sticky quality to it, but it lasts for a very short time. It's got like maybe per song, maybe 2 to 6 months lifespan. And then you don't hear it anymore. And that's because the pop music that people make, once again, like no one's invested in it. There's no emotional investment. So you got to get that ingredient back in. You have to get the urgency back in where people really feel like they want to be there.
Thank you very much. Michael, we know that you have some like artist incubation office. Tell us a little bit more about the Beinhorn Creative Consulting Services, music consulting.
Oh, sure. Yeah, I'm making all, I've kind of parsed out the process of music production so I can do it remotely. So I don't have to go into a recording studio and work directly with artists because my time is the thing that tends to cost the most. If I'm working from a remote location and a technology exists where I can analyze people's music on my own and I can sit with it and give them the same kind of input that if they were paying me to produce a record, you know, they're able to get more out of it and not have to break the bank doing it. And also the technology exists for me to actually sit in a recording session now and listen in the highest fidelity possible to someone's recording session. And it's amazing. It's, you know, I think people aren't really used to working remotely yet, but I found that it's not that much different from actually being in the studio and being in the same proximity with people. And yeah, I'm basically separating all these elements up, pre-production, recording, you know, kind of working with people in an executive position, all kinds of stuff, you know, to help people make better music. And once people have the opportunity, this is really exciting. Once people have the opportunity to see what it's like to have their music analyzed, and really kind of all the trouble spots, you know, examined and identified, they get really excited. And all of a sudden, they don't want to rush either because they realize they can see, I can make a better record. I can, you know, they can really see their way clear and they get that vision. And that's so important. You know, if you don't have feedback from outside, it's so much harder to make a record that's going to inspire you. And that's really what this process gives back.
Okay.
Recuerden seguirnos en Instagram @lp.podcast. Michael.
Hello.
Okay. So Michael, in another podcast we did, we spoke to Rob Agnello, who is now actually a pretty good friend of the podcast. He's a recording engineer for Indigo Ranch, where they recorded the first Korn album. He told us that producer Ross Robinson really got into their heads to get like the best and even worst out of them, and managed to get like very intense and magical moments on tape. It was a really psychological thing. No, I understand that for Marilyn Manson's Mechanical Animals, you guys created a vibe. You created like a vibe for the recording. You guys put up like a piping system, heavy black theatrical drape curtains, just created kind of like a really cool vibe. And of course, like for the particular ambience that you wanted for this record, which Marilyn Manson was going after. The producer in this sense also acts kind of like a psychological director to get the best out of a performance. How would you say this works? Because one thing, of course, is the job of the producer to like just technically do stuff. And then another is kind of like the whole, how do you manage kind of like an artist like this? And I'm assuming, of course, every artist has a very different way of doing this, but you do have to get into their heads.
Yeah, you do. But I find that I don't like to manipulate people I work with. I think if it's there, it's going to come out one way or another. You know, I think if you're producing a record, at least from my perspective, you have a certain amount of intuition about what's required from you from moment to moment. Like sometimes you have to give as much space to the artist as possible and be as nurturing as you can to them and for them. And other times you have to be very firm with them in varying degrees, and the situation pretty much dictates how that's going to play out. I have never worked the way Ross does. He's his own man in that sense, and I have tremendous respect for him and for his work. But, you know, I think he and I tend to do things much differently. And the other thing is that I'm looking for something very specific when I work with artists. So I feel that I have a stronger sense of, I have a strong sense of what I want to get out of them, or what they need. I should say what they need to deliver, what needs to happen for the record that we're working on to be great.
Michael, so obviously one of the standout points on this record especially is Chris Cornell's vocal performance. Everybody loves Chris Cornell's vocal performance. And you've stated in previous interviews that Chris Cornell loved to record alone. Do you think this was an insecurity issue, or was it just like a spiritual thing?
Well, I think he'd been, up till that point, he'd been recording, he'd been doing records in the usual way, with him being in the recording studio and an engineer and a producer being in the control room. And it just occurred to me that because Chris actually had been making demos by himself in his house, that he was perfectly capable of recording himself on the record that we were making. So I set him up in the control room that way, and he preferred it to recording the usual way. And I would say that it was mostly to do with a comfort factor, that he just felt more comfortable. And I've seen that with other singers too, that they have a sense that whoever's on the other side of the window is obviously commenting on what they're doing. You know, I mean, think about it. If someone's having a conversation and you can't see what they're saying, but they know it's about you, you're not going to feel too comfortable. And meanwhile, you're in a situation where you need to be as comfortable as possible. Like singing, you want to be in the optimal emotional state or mood that you can be in to do what your work happens to be. So I couldn't possibly take that away from Chris. At that point, my job was to try and make him as comfortable as he could possibly be. And I think once he was able to be by himself and just kind of and not feel like he was being judged or dictated to, he was able to do his best work. It doesn't work with everyone, but it definitely worked with him.
Michael, there's a big difference in sound when comparing the emblematic grunge bands from Seattle, like Soundgarden, Nirvana, Pearl Jam, Alice in Chains. But what do you think is the point where these bands find common grounds, and where can they be at their most distant point?
Common ground. I mean, I hope it's looked upon as being music that means something to people. You know, I mean, I think that's the only commonality that I could find and would want to try and find. I mean, I never considered this record a grunge record per se. It didn't fit into that category. And frankly, that wasn't the kind of record that I wanted to make. And we never had a conversation about this record kind of slotting into an identifiable sound. So my intent, as I think I stated earlier, was to try and make something that would kind of stand on its own and be completely, I guess, as disparate as possible from anything else that other people were making at the time. So, yeah, I mean, I think ideally it's all great music that people can enjoy for, you know, for its uniqueness. Each band, each record is different from one another, even within the cycle of each band making their, you know, their group of records, you know. And as far as separate, you know, it's the individual identity of the artists and what they're doing. It should always be like that.
Recuerden, amigos, seguirnos en nuestro fanpage de Facebook como LP. Por favor, inviten a todos sus amigos a que nos sigan. Y muchas gracias por estar acá. So, Michael.
Yes.
It's a pleasure to be with you here. Thank you so much for your time.
Oh, sure. Thanks.
Michael, what do you think is the most successful album you've worked on? Not necessarily from a commercial point of view, but one which you believe you have felt the most proud of or has been the most rewarding for you?
I can't answer that question.
Hey, how come?
Because a great many of them I'm very proud of, and they all mean something different to me. And it's kind of like judging your children. Like,
there's always a favorite,
see what I
though.
Mean?
do you have a favorite album, or you can do a top three, maybe. Top three, not even the.
Do it.
Okay. Not even the gold, bronze, and silver or something like that. Like three that.
Nah, this ain't the Olympics. No. I can't do it.
Just three. That's all.
No. Let's change the question. Basically, we know.
You're asking me to judge my kids.
One of the most challenging we know have been Untouchables from Korn. Why would it have been like that challenging for you, for example?
That one?
Yeah. You've said it's been one of the most challenging ones. Like as a producer, I think you spent a lot of time working on that. And you were actually, I think, like part of the process, like very from the beginning to the very end, no?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, the whole record took about 15 months to make from start to finish. It was a very hard record to make. But yeah, it came out okay. Yeah, you know, it wasn't smooth going, you know. It was hard to get vocals. It was hard to get the songs all written. It took about 7 months for pre-production. But, you know, I mean, everyone hung in there like champs. So we got it done in the end. I was very proud of those guys. They worked their butts off.
So Michael, you've worked on records that, you know, you from the very beginning, you say like, this has to be a very successful album, and it really isn't. And albums that you start working on that you don't have like a lot of expectations come out to be a huge success. What's the common factor in a band, and what's your tips for an aspiring musician who wants to, you know, like be big and strong and have a strong band and be successful?
There's a lot of answers to that one. You know, the first one is be better than everybody else, I think. You know, the second is to not be convinced that you're better than everyone else. So you got to keep like working every single day at it and working your butt off. And just, I find that a lot of people today don't have like the same kind of competitive spirit that people used to have. Like when a record like this was made, you know, everybody on this record, we were all fans of other bands and stuff like that. And those guys were obviously all friendly with the people in their circle of artists that were in Seattle at the time. But you know that like all of us were prepared to knock every single last, you know, artist who'd come before, you know, who'd made their record like the year before or whatever. We had come with something better. I mean, whether or not someone thinks like Alice in Chains is better than Soundgarden, or, you know, or Dirt is a better Supranone or whatever it is. Like, the whole point of it was that everyone was still vying to be the best. Like, people were, it was like heavy competition. It wasn't just a matter of I'm putting a record out. It was like, I'm going to kick your ass and knock it into the dirt, you know? So I think there has to be not a fighting spirit, but a sense of like, I have to be the best at this. You know, and I'm going to push as hard as I can, and nothing's going to get in my way, you know, because these guys lived this, you know, we all did. And that's really how records like this get made. That there's like a superhuman amount of commitment that goes into it. And you really are trying to do something very unique and very special.
Yeah.
How's that?
Yeah, perfect. Just work your ass off is basically the thing.
So be great. And yeah. Be great.
Yeah, yeah. And well, also kind of humble in a way, you know, like except you're doing the best you can, but well.
I think humility is for you personally. Like, if you want to be humble, if you don't want to make any difference. Again, it's kind of like ergonomics and record making. Like, at the end of the day, no one who's listening to the record gives a shit about how, you know, what or your ergonomics were like and how comfy you were when you're making it. Just in the same way that no one cares if, you know, if an artist is humble, if they make a great record, because they've done something for you anyway that's so emotionally profound. It's like, all right, if the guy's an asshole, that's no big deal. You know, he made a great record. I mean, the guys in Soundgarden, when it came down to like at the right time, there was no humility there at all. You know, I mean, there didn't have to be, because it was like, because we're trying to make something amazing. We want to communicate with you. We want to bring you something very special that's going to hopefully change your life, and that you'll be talking about like almost 30 years later. And hey, look, here we are.
Yeah.
it's kind of like
what I'm saying, right?
Yeah. It's kind of like you have to separate the artist from the person. Is that correct? Something like that. Like, you don't know, you don't care if the person is like not humble at all, but it's a great record.
Look at man, like, you read constantly. I mean, we see this where people are kind of like regressing historically and going back to artists like John Lennon and people like this, who were like terrible people sometimes, were just like shitty to other people, and were, you know, could sometimes just take out all their like bad feelings on them, but did amazing stuff. Like, I don't care if someone was a bad person. It doesn't matter to me if they made music that changed my life. Ultimately, they're the ones who had to live with being like a shitty person. I don't have to live with that. I'm listening to their music being inspired by it. Yeah. So yeah, you're absolutely right. You do. It's imperative to separate the artist from the person. Let the art speak for itself. You can condemn the person in a completely different, in a different arena if that's your pleasure, but don't let that get in the way of enjoying their art, you know, or letting their art speak to you and do what it's supposed to do for you, which is to enlighten you and take you to a different place.
Yeah. So how is the Michael Beinhorn of the 90s who produced Supranone different from the Michael Beinhorn today? How have you adapted to modern times, technologically and musically?
Well, I'm certainly walking a little slower these days. I got older. I think a lot of the technology that was used to make these records is wonderful. There's a lot of good technology out there now. I'm not a fan of digital. I'm not as much of a fan of digital recording as I am of analog, but unfortunately, situation dictates that digital recording has to be used in most circumstances, because most people can't afford to record analog as much, excuse me. But I think in terms of working with technology, I've completely changed my approach. I mean, the room that I'm sitting in right now is the room that I do everything in. I don't have a recording studio anymore. I have a bunch of recording equipment, but it's useless to me now because people can't afford to set it up anywhere. It doesn't matter to me. The only thing that matters is, how do I get results with people? The only way that I can get results with people ultimately is being able to listen and being able to discern, to use my brain to process what I'm hearing, to be able to give people good feedback and help them do what they need to do. So I've got like an incredible listening system that I can take everywhere in the world. And that's how I work. It's completely portable. that's it. Yeah. I mean, so if, as far as that goes, I would say it's, I mean, it's similar conceptually, but it's so totally removed from how records like this got made.
Okay, cool. Michael, thank you very much for your time. Thanks for spending the night with us and listening to this awesome record. A todos los conectados, muchas gracias. Gracias por su tiempo. Nos vemos en 8 días con un disco súper especial que a finales de los 90 revolucionó el sonido para siempre del metal y lo trajo a una nueva etapa. Una gran labor de management, una puesta en escena increíble, unos production managers increíbles. Vamos con Slipknot y su primer disco, Slipknot. Así que, fill your horns, raise your horns. Thank you very much, Michael. Have
Michael,
a great
thank
night.
Thank you very much for your time.
Definitely.
Thank you so much.
Thanks, mate.
I enjoyed that one.
Thanks, Michael.